The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up this week, Britain basks in the Olympics afterglow, but will the mood of optimistic overachievement spill over into politics? And with Britain's embrace of the flag from Cardiff to Cumbernauld, have the Games strengthened the union? Also this week, just when you thought the US election race couldn't get any more divisive, enter Paul Ryan. Mitt Romney's running mate is a fundamentalist disciple of Ayn Rand with a mission to slash government and terminate state healthcare. Just don't tell those millions of Americans whose votes are needed in November. Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's political diarist Hugh Muir, the columnist and Church of England minister Giles Fraser, and down the line, we have our favourite political sage, Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, a week, as is sometimes said, is a long time in politics, and especially when nothing much is happening. David Cameron and Nick Clegg are both on holiday and in their quiet moments will be reflecting on an extraordinary 2 weeks. Britain appeared to put aside all of its internal differences and pull together to cheer on its athletes. Mike White, it was the kind of support that politicians can only dream of, but can it in any way be tapped into?
No, not in terms of the party leaders. I don't think people are disaffected, as everybody knows, deeply from politics. Many of them were disaffected from the Games. I was in the East Midlands this week and was asking people, what did you think of the Games? And several of them said to me, well, I wasn't looking forward to it much and I feared the worst, but actually it was fine. And I think many of us have been taken pleasantly by surprise by what happened. Can you bottle it? No. And if the politicians are sensible, they won't try, although I can already hear them at their party conferences saying, this shows the real Britain, which in Cameron's case is elitist and competitive, and in the case of Ed Miliband and no doubt Nick Clegg is anti-elitist, team spirit, may the best man win, and jolly good social democratic sensibilities a la Danny Boyle all around. It won't wash, I'm afraid. I wish we could bottle it. We can't.
So, Mike, they're saying what I have to say, the opinion polls seem to show as well, Giles, which is that a kind of relatively even split on enthusiasm before the Games has hardened into something more like enthusiasm, but not, I believe, in your case.
No, I've kept the faith. I think too many people have backslided on this Olympic thing, that they started by being, you know, properly negative and sceptical, as they should have sustained it. And they, you know, in the end, Winston Smith finally loves Big Brother, and that's what's happened with many people. It's £9 billion worth of compulsory enjoyment for people. And, I spent sports days smoking behind the bike shed, and that's what I felt like doing throughout the whole time.
So, Hugh, there's no winners in competitive sports, says Giles.
I think that's a good catchphrase. But £9 billion was spent on much more than that, wasn't it? And I'll put my cards on the table. I speak as the professional East Londoner. So I was delighted. It cost too much money, but I don't mind that either. And I think that we'll get on to the politics in a minute, but just in terms of what it may have done for the country, well, here you have a very underperforming bit of London. London is the engine of the economy. We finally, after about 100 years, done something about that underperforming bit of the economy.
Well, it hasn't given many jobs to East Londoners. I mean, there's it's given you the biggest McDonald's in the world.
Not yet.
Oh, well, okay, that's the question. That's the $9 billion question.
As to the politics, I think it's not obviously going to transform the fortunes of the government, but if you're in the position that they're in, isn't this prime relaunch material? Doesn't it give you some kind of launch pad to try and have another relaunch, and God knows they need one?
And Mike's already suggested some of the phrases that like to be used. It has to be said that as far as any of the political parties are concerned, it looks like the Olympics have had close to zilch effects. A 9-point Labour lead before the election with YouGov, 8-point Labour lead after the Olympics, sorry. But what it does seem to have done is produce some very clear winners. One is the NHS, lauded in Danny Boyle's opening ceremony, now more popular than it's been for a little while, apparently. Another one is Another one is multiculturalism. People are a bit kinder about that than they might have been before, although that looks like it's not spilt over into immigration. And another one, of course, Hugh, is Boris Johnson, who looks like he's cashed in a way that David Cameron hasn't.
Well, you know, you look at him and it's kind of either the London very posh version of Monsieur Hulot or maybe Mr. Magoo. You know, you think that he's shambling on and making mistakes, but actually strategically he's quite clever. He's quite clever in terms of constructing his own career. And I think he's played the Olympics absolutely fantastically. Cameron's away. He's got all of the limelight and he's milked it for all it's worth and to good effect. You know, you look at the papers today and the Daily Mail. I hate to say it, but Boris is right. Our leaders are fiddling while the economy burns. He's talking about the need for more investment, which he knows is pretty much the zeitgeist now. Everyone's saying that George Osborne's kind of running into the sand and he needs to think about growth. Well, Boris is saying that now. So I don't think Boris has I think he has a limited set of cards, but he's playing them very well at the moment. The thing I would add, though, is that I spoke this morning to a couple of Tory MPs and very useful doing that because they gave us a grown-up opinion, which is this, that yes, this is all very good summer fun, but what we really need to do to win an election is two things. One, we need to win a lot of seats in the north, which Boris probably won't do. And two, as Lord Ashcroft's studies have shown, we need to get into an ethnic minority vote, which Boris probably won't do. So this is all a lot of fun. But actually, when MPs look at him and decide, you know, is this our messiah? Is this the way we should go? It might not be as straightforward as we think it now.
Interesting. Mike, do you think it's just a bit of summer fun, summer lightning or something? Or do you think...
Oh, yeah, Boris is part of the silly season. He is a clever fellow. And you never underestimate the capacity of someone like Boris to make everybody laugh even when they don't want to. He's a natural clown, but he's a clever man, an ambitious one. I still can't wake up in the morning and believe Boris is going anywhere serious. He hasn't done much. He was a failure as an MP. Nonetheless, it's worth watching. And I mean, to row back a bit, when I said the Olympics won't do anything for politics and politicians, I stand by that. But I agree with Hugh that deprived part of London, very deprived, it comes up in all the indices, pretty high up along with parts of the north of England and inner city, Liverpool and so on. So that's a good thing for East London. And it could have incalculable positive effects. So I don't share Giles's slightly Old Testament view of it all. It's all wickedness and a waste of money. But the most important thing, it seemed to me, from the Olympics, which isn't political with a capital P, it did remind us that we are capable, A, of doing something against a deadline when we have to. We pull the stops out, but only when our backs are against the wall. And B, there are things which manage to generate a genuine sense of national unity. And I wouldn't want to overestimate the point. I'm sure Alex Salmon wasn't thrilled. I'm sure the BNP and the English Defence League weren't thrilled. And a lot of people, including that idiot backbencher, whose name I have happily forgotten.
Aidan Burley.
That's
from
Cannock.
I claim my prize.
Well, don't give him any more publicity. I said it was
no reminder. Everybody, what he said. We need to remind everybody what he said about that opening ceremony being multicultural crap. And actually, it was. You know, what did we get on that whole in the whole Olympics? The best bit of it is exactly all that stuff about diversity.
And of course, Labour have a campaign to get rid of him as well, which I heartily endorse.
Well, the fact is, one way or another, it was a unifying occasion, and it may have indeed been on social democratic terms, but you could say, a couple of months ago, we had the Royal Jubilee on a unifying occasion against some people's predictions and expectations on sort of Tory terms. So there are things where we can overcome our tribalism, and that's always to be welcomed. Countries which are deeply fractured are always more vulnerable than those who can pull off this particular trick.
I never clocked at the time, but did in retrospect, it was about 1948, wasn't it? That's where you had the NHS and the Empire Windrush, because both things took place in the same year as the Olympics were last in London, Hugh.
Yeah, and I think you allude to the way we the improvement there might be in terms of the way people view multiculturalism. I think it was one of the most encouraging things in that the people's background mattered, but it didn't matter. You know, people were I think across the country just united in looking at that team and feeling this is a British team in a way that I've not quite felt has happened before. And so I think that's a marvellous thing. But just one thing I'd put out there about the impact this might have on politics. I think might it just not put the public in a mood where politicians can talk to them again? Because we've all been so crotchety and we've all been so bad-tempered since the expenses scandal that really it's been very difficult to do any business with our politicians, for the politicians to even engage with the public, because we've just not really been in a mood to listen to them or to talk to them. Might be that the lightening of the public mood from the Olympics, might that be an opportunity for politicians to actually engage with the public again?
It's a lovely thought.
What do you think, Charles?
But it'll be business as usual when the rain comes in a few weeks' time and it starts getting colder. I mean, is it part of the silly season and the fun and just summer fun? And I just don't know. The really, really interesting thing is what the figures will look like about how many people feel positive about the Olympics in 6 months' time. And that's the real thing. I mean, whether this is just something that a lot of people, not me, but a lot of people have just enjoyed, and whether it actually... This is a big financial hangover from it when we realise that actually after we've waved all the flags, nothing's ever changed, then that'll be the interesting thing.
I mean, it does depend, as always in the last couple of years in politics, Mike, on whether or not we get a Eurogeddon, doesn't it? Because if we do, people might start to feel that everything else was a bit of a distraction.
Well, no, I think, you know, a warm glow is a warm glow. And people can be united by negative events too. Dunkirk is the one we always offer. But Dunkirk and the Blitz were real enough and people did rally around. The European news persists in being depressing, but the wider world news persists in being depressing. We're in big trouble, all of us, and it's not just about the banking crisis or the related Eurozone crisis, all tied up with an excess of credit in the Western world, which was deployed, I think, to make up for the loss of competitiveness and the loss of real-term wages as China and India and South Asia in general came up and has, you know, restored a balance in the world which has not been there for over 500 years. And this is the really profound change. And it's going to keep us in a bad place. And America and France and pretty well everybody, even the Germans in the long run, which we haven't been for a very long time. And it's going to last a long time. And that will call on all our resources of mutual goodwill. And we're all in this together. It will test them hard. So this event showed... You know, we can pull together. We can be all in the Olympics together, and it can be okay. And we're going to need that sort of feeling because this economic recession isn't going to go away.
I'm pleased you added that little silver lining for us at the end there, Mike, because we were all sort of getting quite close to the edge there. But
Charles... Well, we in the newspaper business are close to the edge. Ours is a crisis involving a particular industry, and it's a complicated one, but, you know, we're bleeding too, so we know it. You know, there are redundancies all over our industry and indeed our company all the time, so it's not just other people we're talking about for once.
Giles, what do you think, like the Olympics or loathe them, about the fact that if a lot of people have been very entertained and cheered by people doing rather well in a Union Jack T-shirt, that's going to make them think, well, maybe this old United Kingdom thing isn't such a bad do after all. And in particular, do you think Alex Salmond, as Mike suggests, might not have been entirely happy to watch Scott's Chris Hoy picking up another couple of gold medals?
I just don't believe in, you know, when you've had that awful sentimental, I want to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony, you know, view of flag waving sort of togetherness and so forth. I just don't believe that sort of thing ever has any permanence. I think that real unity is rooted in something actually much more prosaic than that, in, you know, economic conditions and the fact that, you know, poor people's circumstances are improving. And I actually think that, you know, the disunity in our country is not going to be solved by 2 weeks of fun in the sun.
Does anyone think it will, though? I think morale does get you somewhere, and if an event like this raises morale, then it does. Doesn't it help you, you know, achieve what you want to achieve?
Well, okay. I want to have this conversation in 6 months' time and see whether it's made any difference.
Let's do that, but in the meantime, let's zip over the water to the United States, where 4 years ago, hope was very much the commodity as Barack Obama won his election and promised hope. But of course, conditions for many Americans haven't improved as much as they would have hoped, with unemployment stubbornly above 8%. It's been a long and meandering campaign so far, with Mitt Romney gradually emerging as the presumptive Republican candidate, although without any real enthusiasm on the part of his party. But this week, he suddenly achieved something of a moment by making the bold or even courageous selection of Paul Ryan, who is a fierce fiscal hawk who's already published his own slash and burn budget. Now, Mike, what did you make of it? Normally you bring a new face to these campaigns at this kind of point, don't you? Whereas by selecting Paul Ryan, he's also bringing a budget and therefore turning himself into a bit of a target in a way, isn't he?
Ryan is a new face for most Americans who probably couldn't even name the vice president. So to that extent, Romney was highly risk-averse. That's what Bain Capital was all about, as well as his political career. Strange, strange man. Has taken a huge risk here. And I clocked it immediately by turning to the profiles of Paul Ryan in the conservative press in London and a bit in the American media as well. And the conservatives say, you know, it's the old yes minister joke. That's a very brave choice, Mr. Romney. It's a risk. And their admiration for Romney as a slash, for Ryan as a slash and burn man is tempered by the fear that he frightens even Republicans. A phrase I picked up somewhere. I love, Republicans in Washington say, I love Paul, but. And the feeling that middle America will be frightened off by him because he wants to slash American healthcare, public healthcare, which of course they all think it's all private, but in fact, much of the bill is picked up by the U.S. taxpayer for the poor and the elderly, far bigger budget than the NHS, but it's just a lousy system and it's unfair and inefficient, they know that. But Ryan is also more interesting, and this has already begun to come through. Despite all this slash and burn stuff, get the federal share of the budget down to heaven knows what, horrendous figures at great cost on everything except defense. He also likes to bring a lot of pork barrel home to his district, to Janesville, Wisconsin, where he comes from. I'm reading a list here from a rival newspaper. He got a $400,000 water treatment subsidy, $375,000 for the city bus system, $300,000 for a technical college, and a lot of stuff. And he even supported Obama's plan to rescue General Motors when all the right-wing economists and their kind were saying, let it go, in the same way as they let Lehman Brothers go with disastrous consequences, Ryman. So he kind of, he's long on the rhetoric, but when it comes to putting his hand out, he's as good as anybody else. I've said here before, Obama's slogan on the first week in November should be, General Motors is still alive and Osama bin Laden is dead. That's not a bad slogan to get re-elected on in a tough electorate where people are suffering, same as they are here. It's very bad for middle America. The middle American, middle class wages have been flat for 20 years. I could go on for hours about this. It's awful.
You could. Charles, now, you're the only one around the table who's read, I think, When Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
It was a miserable experience.
Yeah, Paul Ryan's a Randite as well.
He is indeed.
Charles is going to tell us what a Randite is.
Oh, well, Ayn Rand, it looks like Anne, but it's Ayn, and it's very confusing, is a sort of Russian-Jewish emigre to the States who proposed this sort of philosophy of objectivism, which no decent philosopher has any time for whatever, but it's a sort of cult status thing in America. The virtue of selfishness, the idea that sort of muscular individualism is really the only virtuous way forward, and anything collective is not just, you know, misplaced, it's actually wicked. I mean, you know, the Good Samaritan was doing something morally wrong. The only real important virtue is doing things for yourselves. Atlas Shrugged is this awful idea that the sort of rich, powerful industrialists go on strike, and you'll all see, you poor people, what happens then. And because they're the atlases that hold up the world. And if they shrug, then the ordinary people are buggered. And so we must celebrate them. They're the great things.
It's now, awful. You like Nietzsche. This is a slight detour, but you like Nietzsche, who was into this super...
No, I'm not getting into Nietzsche, because I could go on more than Mr. White about Nietzsche. It's not quite the same as... I mean, you do get that celebration of the sort of Übermensch, yeah, and so forth. But Nietzsche's a much bigger, much more subtle and significant thinker than an Ayn Rand, who's just, you know, this sort of cult of individual selfishness. But the interesting thing is, you know, she's a passionate atheist and thinks Christianity celebrates, you know, sort of turning the other cheek and giving to the other, which and sort of much more collective view of the world. The problem is, how can a politician like Paul Ryan celebrate so, you know, completely give them out as Christmas presents, Atlas Shrugged as Christmas presents, Ayn Rand, in a country where Christianity is such an important vote winner? And the truth is, he's just backtracked. He said, oh, no, I'm not really a Randian. I'm not really. He is.
Preferred Jesus. So he certainly sounds a bit different, doesn't he, Hugh, to Sarah Palin?
Doesn't it just show, well, it's kind of painting with the brain, isn't it? Because actually, whereas she didn't have any grasp of detail, he has a lot of grasp of detail. But you look at this choice and you think, what is Romney doing? Was this thought process that everyone was just going to be fast asleep come time to vote, and maybe he needed to do something to wake them up? So let's give them something, someone exciting, and something that the reporters can get hold of and write good stories about. Because, you know, there's a piece in the Mail today, and there's a marvellous description of Ryan. He catches catfish in his bare hands, hunts deer with a bow, and turns them into homemade sausages. I mean,
which of our... And he's got 9% body fat. Absolutely. Isn't that the other thing?
No, it's 6%.
See, 6%.
You see, you're already misrepresenting him, and I expect more of that sort of thing during this election.
There's an important point here about the changing shape of America as of the world.
And sausages.
And body fat.
Bill Clinton said, you know, it's okay for America to behave unilaterally as long as you think we're always going to be top dog. And if you don't think that, then we better start agreeing rules with other people who may be in a position to enforce them against us. Most Americans, including Paul Ryan, haven't really got that far, the possibility that American unilateralism and hegemony, dreadful word, is over. Ryan's one of those, so all that fits. But in another way, he represents a changed America, because this is the first election when no white Anglo-Saxon Protestant has been on the ticket, Veep or president, of either of the major parties, and the only Protestant in sight at the moment is Obama, and as you've probably noticed, he's black. And the people who represent the Tea Party and who love Paul Ryan are rapidly becoming white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, fundamentalists, many of them, a minority in their own country. It's an extraordinary change, but it reflects a change in the wider world as well. The world has changed profoundly in the last 20 years.
In American elections, they go for the detail, and they're going to pull him apart, aren't they? We already know that, as Charles was saying, his guru appears to be Ayn Rand, but then he has to repudiate half of it. He'll talk about the need for a small state, and as you've said, he's been quite happy to benefit from a large state, both personally and in terms of the area that he represents. And this is the sort of thing, once the election gets going, will mean that he just won't be credible. And isn't that the sort of contradiction that means that American candidates crash and burn?
Well, of course, the other thing, I mean, when you say that, I think probably is, when I look at a candidate like this, what I think of something different to that, I just think that Americans are on a different political planet than us. I mean, it's just that they're from Mars and we're from Venus. I mean,
that's right.
The idea that somebody like this could come within a million miles of any sort of political office in this country is completely impossible to conceive.
It's classic divided by a common language, isn't it?
No, I don't think that's true, actually. I think there are parts of the American body politic which are recognisably like our own. A guy called Bernie Sanders, who's a senator these days from Vermont, used to be mayor of Burlington. I met him once, who got elected as a socialist. I think he's the only one, but there is a sort of social democratic tradition, liberalism they call it there by and large, in the United States, which is visible, and we shouldn't accentuate the differences. It is weird. It is too driven by money, and the Supreme Court ruling, which allowed big money in again, made it worse. But don't fall for that mistake. We all have the same problems, and we're all in the same sort of trouble at the moment.
But this kind of politician and Sarah Palin would be cut to ribbons in this country.
Well, Boris is doing all right.
Yeah, but Boris doesn't have the sort of views they have, and also he just doesn't mess up in the way that they tend to, and he doesn't come from the extreme of politics that they do.
The Guardian was saying 3 or 4 years ago about Boris, I feel bound to point out, we were wrong, so I'll meet you halfway there, Huey.
Now, Mike, you've suggested a very winning slogan there for Barack Obama. I think he's about 4 or 5 points ahead. So kind of, you know, nothing sealed. But from this distance and with what looks like the final lineup of candidates and deputies now, are you feeling pretty confident that he'll get back in? No,
I wasn't confident for Obama in 2008. I wait until the votes are counted. In the event, it was a great and seismic, profound shift and a moving occasion. He's been a disappointing president. Nobody gets re-elected normally when unemployment is 8-9%. On the other hand, he's lucky with an opponent. He's a great campaigner. He's up against a lot of money. I'm still pretty cautious about this. You know, so many things can go wrong, and he's been a disappointing president. He's been a disappointing president in many, many ways. He's not a bad man, but it's been cautious and, oh, all sorts of things. We all know that.
Well, that's all for this week. We will have a chance to chew over again, I'm sure, the American election as it comes nearer. My thanks to Hugh Muir, to Giles Fraser and to Michael White. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark. Next week, I'm off away and we'll be passing the podcast baton in Olympic fashion over to Hugh, who will be providing.
We'll drop it.
No.
Harris is off. The handover will happen before the yellow line. We'll be sure of that.
Smoothly, and another world record. Thank you very much for listening, and speak to you soon.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.